You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station, Joy 94.9.
Good evening, my name's Nicola and you're listening to Hear Me Raw, Joy's all-female current affairs programme. Co-hosting with me tonight is the lovely Cathy.
Oh, I like being lovely, how are you?
Okay, except my socks have put me in a bad mood. I put on two perfect pairs of, like a pair of socks this morning.
Yep.
Same as all my other black pairs of socks.
Yeah.
This pair, the elastic's gone in one and it's been scrunching down inside my shoe all day. And I've managed to rip a hole out the heel on the other one. So I have got two dysfunctional socks. And it'd be okay if both were scrunching or both had holes in the heels, but I just...
Yeah, it's hard when it's uneven, isn't it? I don't know how you manage to have two socks that are the same, because I cannot tell you the amount of orphans that are in my sock drawer, and I don't know whether it's my dog stealing them or they go into my flatmate's laundry basket or whatever it is. I don't know. It's confusing.
You've got a sock monster in your washing machine.
It's a gremlin.
Yes. Anyway, back to current affairs and such like, rather than my socks. Tonight we've got Jean Taylor, who's been a member of various feminist activist collectives.
Well, there's a lot of activity involved in feminism,
yes,
as we'll find out.
Yes, and the women's liberation movement since the early 1970s, including the Victorian Women's Liberation and Lesbian Feminist Archives. And we've also got Ardie Tibby, who's in the lesbian enlarger community. She's heavily involved in the lesbian archives as well, and two publishing groups. Ardie describes herself as being proud, loud, joyous, bearded lesbian.
That's right. She's one of the two of them actually are in the older women's circus, which many of the people who were at Pride may have seen them marching down Fitzroy Street. So it'll be really interesting to talk to them. We're going to be discussing all things feminism. We're going to talk about language. We're going to talk about stereotypes and anything else that sort of pops up.
Well, we better kick in to the current affairs stuff.
Yeah.
And the first story we probably should have a wee look at is just to acknowledge the politicians in Queensland who had their 17-hour debate on a rare government-conscious vote in Queensland to do with surrogacy. And
altruistic surrogacy. And this is a debate that's been going for a long time. Because Queensland is probably one of our most conservative states when it comes to legislation like this. And the opposition was trying to put up a bill to say that gay couples, men in particular, who, you know, gay dads who would want to have a woman have a baby for them using, you know, their sperm, eggs, donated eggs, whichever. The opposition was trying to ban gay couples from doing so because of all sorts of parenting, you know, right issues, blah blah blah. But however, they weren't successful, and the bill has been passed.
Fantastic news! It was actually interesting. One of the things that I believe the people were against that were saying was that children benefited most from having a man and woman as parents. That's quite outdated, and I'd like to see their research, because I don't know if you remember, Cathy, a few months back in the show, we actually had some research from a UK study.
Yeah, that's right.
That showed that lesbians were better parents.
Who knew?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. And I think what these people kind of overlook when they're giving these arguments against, you know, single-sex parents is that a lot of families these days don't stay together, that men and, you know, husbands and wives can result in dysfunctional families as well. There's a lot of kids who have single-parent families. And the thing is with a lot of rainbow families, if we want to give it a collective name, is that if there's a donor or if there's a mother involved, there are male and female influences in that child's life, and often they have three or four sets of grandparents. And how cool is that, really?
Yeah.
More presents, you get more attention.
Oh, absolutely. And I can see that, you know, I don't know if the ratio for me of being one against one with children is even enough, because there's... Whenever I look after my partner's nieces and nephews, if there's more than one of them and me, then they run rings around me. I think the more people that can be involved in raising a child, the better.
It's a safety net, is all you're saying?
Yeah, maybe it's just that I shouldn't be left alone with, like, children.
Maybe you need to pass a parenting test.
Maybe.
That's probably what the opposition in Queensland were thinking. But anyway, on to happier news. Heading to Sydney.
Sydney.
For Mardi Gras. Now, Mardi Gras is coming up this year, and they have just announced a new chief of parade, which is a very prominent position. Margaret Cho has been chief of parade before, and they have new Mardi Gras has just announced that the world-famous transsexual icon, interesting that they call her transgender, Amanda Lepore has been announced. She's a model, a hostess, performer, singer, actress, and she's a muse as well. And she's coming out to do some shows too, actually, with the Cool Kids Club. So she'll be there. So it's very interesting change of focus for them. Probably very good timing that she's coming to Australia anyway.
Yeah, it sounds like she's an all-round kind of talented bird, though. I mean, that's a lot of things to have, you know, on your CV. She's one of those model slash actress slash, you know.
Hostess with the most, I think.
Multi-talented. I mean, I think I like their choice of Rupert Everett best. That's one of my favourites.
Oh, yeah.
Who would you choose?
He was awesome.
If you could just, like, pick anyone and go, right, you'll do... Oh, see, I've put you in the spot now.
Oh, see, I think someone like Ellen DeGeneres would be awesome.
Of course.
You know, I mean, she's one of the most high-profile lesbians, so maybe she and Portia could do a sort of joint thing or something. But she's so out there, and I think the thing about choosing a chief of parade is that you do get, it's the celebrity factor, you know, which is why they've had, you know, Matthew Mitchum, who was there, you know, before Margaret Cho, Rupert Everett. So I think this is... probably a bit more time, but I think Ellen would be really good. I think Elton John would be awesome. Imagine having him.
Oh, that would be pretty impressive.
Yeah, he'd probably have to have something like the Pope Mobile, though, wouldn't he? Something that's a little bit more protected, so people couldn't throw themselves at him.
Yeah, I believe he spends more money in a year in flowers than most people earn. So I don't think. You know, stumping up for a Pope Mobile would actually probably be small change for him. Hopefully he wouldn't want Mardi Gras to provide it. I shouldn't get into the logistics of it, really. But
The other exciting thing about Mardi Gras is that for the third year in a row, they're actually doing a Mardi Gras Youth Festival. And this is really good news for younger people who want to go up to Mardi Gras, don't necessarily want to be involved in sleazeball or in the parties, in the big, you know, drug and alcohol scene. And they're having the theme this year is really cute. It's called Aquarium.
Yeah.
So they're having a full day of aquarium themed and fish themed, you know, workshops and seminars, as well as they have a 21 down, I think it's called. It's their sort of underage alcohol and drug free dance party.
So it's only for people 21 and under. I'm not eligible.
I'm not sure what the age limits are, but yeah, you're definitely out of the youth league. Oh, sorry, Nick.
Damn it. Yeah, it was very sad when I found I could no longer, you know, because 25 used to be the cut-off for being youth.
Oh, yeah, tell me about it. It's kind of like one of those moments where you turn a certain age, and 35 was a big one for me, and that's not that long ago, listeners, but 35, you change, like when you fill in forms, you jump an age bracket.
Oh, the other box.
Yeah, I'm down with the oldies, like I'm in the bottom, you know, I'm in the bottom percentile. It's not cool. We've just got a message from Dan to say that we have an interview with Amanda Lepore for our national broadcast of the Mardi Gras live from Sydney. Because Joy does an amazing job up there.
Joy's everywhere. We're covering everything. We're on it.
Yeah. You had a van. I think it was the year before last year. And you had this amazing big van with Joy and Joy dancers and teamed up with some of the Victorian marchers. It was really fun.
Tell you what, it does give me the warm and fuzzies when I see Joy represented at all the big events. I love it that we put in a show.
Yeah. Well, we are Australia's only gay and lesbian radio station.
Quite correct. Hmm. Now, our next story is about holding the hand.
instead of the man.
Yeah. So apparently a Canadian researcher is basically asking what it takes to make us hold hands and who takes the lead and essentially, you know, what's hand-holding all about? And he's calling to Australia's gay and lesbian community to take part in a worldwide study. So he wants to know about us.
Yeah.
I mean, that's on a worldwide scale, so it's quite nice to be asked, isn't it?
Look, I think I met this guy. He came around and did some sort of face-to-face stuff at Pride, and we were all sitting in Katani Gardens and gave us the slips, and I haven't done it yet, but I'm going to. And I think it's really fascinating because a lot of people don't hold hands. And particularly a lot of gay people who may not be out in the open or, you know, may not feel comfortable doing so, don't like the looks they get and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. Do you hold your partner's hand in public?
Yeah, absolutely. But I think we've both got a bit of a... We'll walk down the street and you don't have to say anything, but if we come into a situation where we think there is going to be any sort of issue,
yeah.
For example, large group drunk guys,
yep.
We just automatically drop hands, no big deal made about it, just... and keep walking.
Isn't that funny? I do that as well. And not, it's, only since you said that it's just an unconscious thing, I thought, yeah, that's what we do too. That you just, you see, you, it's almost like you see a potential threat or you see a potential for smarty pants comments, which has never happened to me, by the way. But maybe it's because of all my preemptive measures.
Mm, well, it happened to us once, unsuspectingly, the group of guys came out a street behind us and it was on Chapel Street, Paran, middle of the day, just a bunch of young guys. So like, oh, you guys are lesbians. And we're like, way, clever boy. So, but yeah.
How old were they?
Oh, they're probably about 18, 19, old enough to know better, basically. Right. But yeah.
Safety in numbers, though, if you want to be a little smarty pants.
Yeah, it's happened a few times on Chapel Street, of all places.
Yeah, that's funny. I live right off Chapel Street, and it's never happened to me. Although I did go to dinner with some friends last night, and some bloke, before I got there, was giving some lip to two of my friends.
Oh, no.
As well,
way.
Yeah, saying, well, don't you like men? I'm like, oh, not you. Actually, they're like you.
The funniest one I heard was a few weeks ago, walking down Chapel Street, my partner, and she was just a little bit behind me. I was looking in the window or something, and this guy leans out the car window and goes, hey, sexy lady, you want to come back to my place? My mum's away for the weekend. And first of all, you're leaning out the passenger seat of your mate's bomb, and B, you live with your mother. As if, even if I was a single straight woman, I would go back with you after shouting at me out a car window. I wonder if it's ever worked for him.
What did you do?
She just kind of looked at him, like, in disbelief. You know, it was taken, like, did he just say that? Turned around and walked off.
Oh, that's too funny. I hate those situations, though, when you're just so dumbfounded by other people's stupidity that you're too struck to say anything smart. And then you think of about 50 funny comeback lines later on and just go, why not just tell him X, Y, Z, blah, blah? Why don't I fire something off that was a bit, you know... bit better than just looking at him dumbfounded with my jaw dropped.
Yeah, but I suppose we should get back to the handholding where it all began.
Sorry. Yeah.
But, I suppose it's interesting as well that people of different age groups have maybe grown up with it always being a threat, no matter where you were holding hands, would probably be less likely to do it full stop.
Yeah. Or public displays of affection generally. It may not just necessarily be a gay thing. It might just be or some people might really love to do it because it's more of an ownership thing. Like, this is my person. I'm going to hang on to you. You know, don't go anywhere. Or some other people just might like just not be into it. I'd be interested to hear what our listeners think, actually.
Yeah. It's such a simple thing, but I never really thought about the kind of meaning of it. Because my ex used to always get really annoyed that I never held her hand very often.
Yeah.
Yeah, why don't you hold my hand? I was like, I don't know, I just don't hold your hand. And now I'm really, really much more, and I don't know whether it's because I'm much more comfortable in myself or whether, you know, just
Oh, this is nice.
Yeah.
It's tactile.
Aww.
I like it.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. So the next one is about John Mayer. Speaking of idiot boys saying things that they shouldn't.
John Mayer made headlines this week when he gave an interview to Playboy, and I think, you know, this is the ex-boyfriend of Jessica Simpson and Jennifer Aniston. Basically, he came out and said a few things, and the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation is asking Twitter, or people who are on Twitter, to tweet John Mayer, because he's a notorious tweeter, that he apologised for using the anti-gay F-word, which is fag, in his in a segment of his Playboy interview. He's talking about when he saw Perez Hilton and he gave him a kiss, and he said, I grabbed him and gave him the dirtiest, tongueiest kiss I have ever put on anybody, almost as if I hated fags. I don't think my mouth was even touching when I was tongue kissing him. That's how disgusting this kiss was. I'm a little ashamed. I think it lasted for half a minute. Blah, blah.
Wow. You know, it's funny because to begin with, when it was talking about the anti-gay F word, I was going, but the F word's not anti-gay, really. And then I realised this.
Yeah.
Oh.
Not that F word, yeah. The other F word.
I think I was failing as a gay person there. But no, that, yeah. It's just kind of ridiculous that you can still see that kind of stuff.
Well, it all comes down to the use of language and what we find inappropriate and what we find offensive. And it'll be interesting to talk to Jean later as well, because we're talking about the feminization of language and how language is becoming a bit more PC, you know, like the whole manhole and history versus herstory, which is part of the title of her book. So, and some people still find those, you know, terms offensive if someone who isn't part of the community says them, a little bit like, you know, a or offensive words for African Americans or for, you know, the dark word some people to find offensive.
So it's okay to be used within the community. Like yeah, I suppose, like if my gay mates are calling each other fags, it would be not a big deal at all. It's that kind of
yeah, or the, you know, or poofda, like when I talk to my flatmate, I might say it jokingly, but I would never say it outside of our relationship, and he's, you know, he's fine with it. He's not, just thinks it's funny. But we would never go out and say that in public.
I think it also has a lot to do with your intention. If you're you know, how you're trying to use the word. I mean, nearly any word you use could be offensive if you use it. You know, with malice behind it.
Yeah, if it's used to belittle somebody.
Yes, indeed. So yeah, John's not pleasing us, but it's going to be very interesting when we get into that chat about language in a little while. Yes, and tonight we're lucky enough to be joined with Jean Taylor, who's been a member of various feminist activist collectives, including the Victorian Women's Liberation. Everything's got such long names. There's always at least three words in any, you know,
too many syllables.
Yeah, absolutely. And Jean's recently released her book, Brazen Hussy, a herstory of radical activism in the women's liberation movement in Victoria, 1970 to 1979. Tonight we'll be talking to Jean and Ardy about, loads of things to do with feminism, which I must admit, I'm not very good on feminist stuff. I'm a little bit... look, obviously feminism has got me the lifestyle that I have today. But what does one have to do to be a feminist? I mean, I don't know if I am one or not.
to quote somebody whose name I've forgotten, you are a feminist if you refuse to be a doormat.
All right. Well, in that term, maybe I am.
I think it was Rebecca West.
Was it?
Yeah, I don't know. I couldn't name... That's what I was saying before. I was trying to think if I knew any feminists.
Any feminist authors.
Germaine Greer?
Well, that's what I said.
I recognised her name. I didn't know that was what she was to do with, though.
Well, see, in 1970, Germaine Greer put out The Female Eunuch, which is one of the big books way back in the early days of the Women's Liberation Movement. And what was very inspirational to us Australians was that Germaine Greer, being an Australian, here she was, has written one of the big books, internationally renowned books. So it kind of put us... you know, on the agenda, really, and it made us feel a little bit included, apart from the fact that we were being very active on our own behalf.
So in terms of being active as a feminist, because the term feminist really has activism connotations, I want people to text in too to ask you guys some questions about feminism, because I think this is really important, because we talk a lot about, you know, where feminism has got us, as Nicola just said, and whether or not we're continuing the fight, because there is that connotation that if you are a feminist, you do go out in the streets and you wave flags and you make people sign petitions and you fight for women's rights. Is the MMI anywhere close to the mark on this, or is it just a massive stereotype?
That's what we certainly did in the 70s and the 80s. You know, at the beginning stages of the women's liberation movement were very, very vibrant, very passionate. We were coming from the 50s and 60s, which is a very repressive era for women. You know, if you were a teacher, you weren't allowed to continue teaching if you got married in the 60s. I mean, that really heavy stuff. So we were coming from an era where we didn't like the fact that we had to wear stockings and pluck our eyebrows and stuff like that, that we really wanted to live our lives as lesbians, if we were a lesbian, as feminists who were recognised as strong women, and we wanted a place in the workforce if we wanted jobs, and that all of that equal pay, for heaven's sake, you know, a very standard thing. But we also wanted abortion. We didn't want to be raped and put on trial for it. We wanted, if we were being bashed, we needed safe places to go. So in the 70s, the women's liberation movement feminists set up a whole lot of collectives. They set up refuges. You know, we did a whole lot of things. And yes, we hit the streets. We wanted to make our voices heard. We set up the women's theatre group in Melbourne. Like, there was a lot of things happening in the 70s and the 80s that were very vibrant. Now, nowadays, it's slightly different. You know, you're coming from a place where you feel that you've inherited a world where you can be out. You can walk down the street. You can kiss your lover in public, you know, without being get too much flack for it. I mean, there's still a lot of pressures on young people coming out, but even so. So I think these days, I only heard the other day that there's actually a third wave of feminism, which I'd never heard of before. But apparently it's been going for quite a while without me even realising.
A third wave. And who makes up this third wave of feminism? Well, and how do they differ from the people that you've been involved in your personal experiences with feminism and activism?
Well, obviously, there's the third wave of feminism, so-called, if it's going, is different, and it's a much more of an individualistic thing. You know, in the old days, it was an issue, you'd been raped, you wanted to get together with your friends and talk about rape and change the law, you got a collective. You put a notice in and said, I want to talk about this issue, anybody else, and there you had a collective, and then you started being active. And these days it's different. I think the internet, you know, a lot of young feminists are on the internet, or they're doing things, yeah, differently, blogs and stuff like that.
Well, before we even got to collectivity, the first step was to realize that as a people, global people, women, were oppressed, that we were not free.
Mm-hmm.
We were forced, either actively forced or culturally forced, into marriage, motherhood, certain roles. So our first step was to get together in these consciousness-raising groups and say, well, I noticed this about my life, and I don't like this about my life, and do you realize that my husband, blah, 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 blah? And then all of a sudden, putting all those personal experiences out onto the table shared, we would think, oh, my gosh, this is happening to all of us. Mm. Oh, my gosh, it's happening to all women. Let's do something. And that's where the activism came from.
Wow, yeah, because, I mean, my friends and I think, are really quite apathetic about everything. Now we go, oh, I really hate this, and that really does my head in. We don't do anything about it. You just kind of go, have a bit of a shrug and sit back down and watch TV, or, you know, go out and talk about how much you hate it, but not necessarily. I think the amazing thing about what the feminist movement has certainly done in the past is taking it that next step and, as you say, going out there and doing something about it. I mean, what would you say is the fundamental, what are the fundamental things that have changed that have, I suppose, allowed people like me to become so lazy?
I don't think you're lazy.
Oh, thank you.
I think that the young ones are extremely active, but you are active about different things than we were. We were fighting for freedom. You have inherited more freedom. So now you are the generation that is taking action, free action, on what concerns you and what your world has brought you to. Our world brought us to awareness of oppression and desire to act about it. Your world has brought you to awareness of other kinds of global issues and activities. At a guess, I would say that probably the first wave of feminism was about suffrage and getting the vote and trying to get some basic civil rights, most of which they didn't get. The second wave was us realizing that we were oppressed and trying to get other freedoms, other ways to be that we hadn't been allowed to be before. And I suppose that the third wave is what might be called ecofeminism, where the consumerism, the global industrial problems, global poverty, those kinds of things are more to your forefront because you have more personal freedom and can do something more about those. Our initial struggle was to free ourselves and our sisters and try and keep us safe and try and offer some possibility to each other. You now have those possibilities, and you're acting out of that.
Except that a lot of those things are still around today.
Oh, yes.
This is the whole thing, even here in Australia. You know, so I think there needs to be a continuance. But even the fact that you're here on Joy Radio, for example, is a political act, really, that you're here keeping airwaves going on behalf of lesbians and gays and, you know, the queer community. I mean, there's a political act in itself.
You guys are making me feel much better about myself here. I'm liking this.
This has raised some really interesting topic, like talking about the different waves. And I really want to see whether some of our listeners can text in or email in and tell us how active they are, if they think they're active, or would they want to be active in doing something political, and what kind of issues affect them, and what do they get? Because I guess the thing is, what gets their blood boiling? Because once you, if you're angry about something or you're not happy about something, that's when you take some action. So, now, Jean, your book, Brazen Hussies, I love it, A History of Radical Activism in Women's Liberation Movement in Victoria, 1970 to 79, possibly one of the longest titles of a book ever written. Now, we just had a look at your bio, and I want to ask you, were married, pregnant at 17, married at 18, and had two children by the time you were 19, and you came out as a lesbian in 1979, which is coincidentally the end period of your book and the history of that nine-year period there. Mm-hmm. Any coincidence?
Well, I actually became a feminist in the early 70s when I started first going to my first CR group in 72. So I'd been a feminist for all of that time. A lot of my friends were lesbians. I'd fallen in love with my best friend in 74, in actual fact, in 73 and 74. And so I was well aware that I had the potential to be a lesbian. I'm not sure why I took so long to come out. And the book kind of tries to look at that development. It's kind of a long thing. But I also, in the book, I don't think lesbians have been given enough credit for their work in the women's liberation movement. There's a lot of dismissive things about the women's liberation movement. It's a middle-class thing. Therefore, it's to be dismissed. Now, here in Melbourne, that's an erroneous thing. Here in Melbourne, the socialist feminists were very strong. It was a very working class. It was very migrant background. A lot of the activists were from the migrant background, from the communist the old communist days, and there were a lot of lesbians coming through. So here in Melbourne, the movement, the women's liberation movement, was dominated by the old lefty communist women, the young lesbian feminists coming up, a lot of the working class women. So the idea that here in Melbourne, the women's liberation movement was made up of middle-class women is quite wrong. In fact, a lot of the middle-class women went into WELL, the Women's Electoral Lobby. So there's a bit of a division between what were considered the ratbag element in the Women's Liberation Movement, who were the gung-ho revolutionaries, and the very nice, polite, wanting a bit of structure, thank you very much, and they didn't like the unstructurelessness of the Women's Liberation Movement. Now, I definitely sided with the Women's Liberation Movement. And so the book, I felt it was also to pay credit to the very strong, stroppy and out lesbians who did a lot of work in the women's liberation movement, but also to honour the older straight women too, who were very instrumental from migrant backgrounds. Ex-communist lefty had been in trade unions for many years. So that combination was a very vibrant, a very political and very active flavour to the women's liberation movement here in Melbourne.
Now, Jean's written a book which we've been talking about, which is basically a herstory of lesbian activism from 1970 to 79 in Melbourne. Now, we're sort of moving a little bit on to this whole idea of language and feminism in language, because talk us through why you've decided to call your book a herstory, H-E-R-S-T-O-R-Y, instead of a history.
Well, back in the 70s... a lot. We changed a lot of our language. The spelling of the word woman, for example, you'll notice in the book that the word woman is spelled W-O-M-Y-N. That's a deliberate choice, but often it was spelled W-O-M-O-N or W-I-M-M-I-N. And so the word history in her story is the same. Now, history is nothing to do with his story. The origins of the word. So it's not a matter of saying, well, that's all about his story at all. But in our radical active way in wanting to change our language, somebody started off. Women started talking about her story, and it fits. You see, her story, his story. You know, even though that. So a lot of people have gone, look, her story is just one of those made up words, which it is, and that's fine, you know, and I'm very happy to use that word. I much prefer her story, and I use the word history sometimes because history is rather brutal and is about the story that a lot of the men tell about their wars and stuff like that, and that is their history, because the men are looking at the wars and the parliaments and all that sort of stuff. And now what I'm writing is nothing to do with that. What I'm writing is about women, and I want it to be her story.
That actually makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
Though I never saw the history thing before.
No. His story. No, neither did I. It doesn't make
sense. See, that's part of the device of consciousness raising. When you see something just slightly altered, you suddenly realize, oh my, that other did mean something or could mean something else, and it doesn't include me, or what kind of language can I use that is inclusive?
It kind of goes against the norm, doesn't it? Because I've seen women, the word women, portrayed in all those forms that you've just mentioned. Mm. Now, is it kind of doing something just for the sake of making a political point? Like, is it practical to be changing our language and changing things?
It doesn't matter. The point is to open our minds and to be able to see differently and see more clearly and make decisions about how we want to use language and how we want to see more.
And it's also to feel included, because more often than not, books are talking about man. Man is still a generic term that's supposed to include all of us. You put the word woman in there and say, well, that's an inclusive term that means all of us. It changes completely, so that if you're reading a text where a feminist is being conscious about using the word her instead of his all the time, it you feel included. You feel this is a book for you. And even now, I still get a buzz on the few occasions where they'll even change the genders around. And that's even radical enough, you know, for some. So that in one chapter they'll say, you know, if they're talking, if it's a textbook, they'll talk about he, and then they'll talk about her, you know, to make women feel included. And it does. You know, but what I want with this book, of course, is to make women feel even more included. This is a book about women, by women, and lesbians for us, and not just...
In the 70s, some of us started to call God she. Well, you can imagine.
Well, I do that, actually. I do that now,
yes,
but
I
don't know whether it's more of a... It's kind of a joke in a way, because you... And I don't mean to be demeaning or take away from that, but it's kind of like you almost do it for a reaction. If God's looking down, well, she better be on her toes or whatever.
But the point is that you are now thinking about where you're included and where you're not and how you can expand that. Recently, there was a discovery of a new... skeleton, a human being skeleton, and it was the skeleton of a woman, and her name, believe it or not, it was Ardy. And in these articles, they're talking about this primitive form of Homo sapien, this female skeleton, and then they go back to talking about primitive forms of man.
But they're calling it he, too,
and
they're
calling it he. So
it's weird.
The assumptions are enormous. Another example, just this came out of the 70s too. We're talking about nature shows, animals. And here are the lions. And the lions are the king of the jungle. They roar, they have big manes. But who is it that really controls the pride? Who is it that does the majority of the hunting? The lioness. So if you look more carefully, if you look at your language more carefully, it expands your concept of what's in the world.
See, I mean, part of me thinks, couldn't we just all adopt man only because it's shorter? You know, human. That's the I see is, you know.
But you could talk about people. I mean, there are terms that don't mean she or he that could be used, but they're not. And this is the difficulty that some of us have with the language, that it's all male-oriented.
But there has been a radical shift in political correctness, and there was a big shift a couple of years ago and then a bit of a backlash later on. Mm-hmm. But changing terms like manhole, mm-hmm. right, to personhole, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and people just going, oh, for God's sake, are we just going too far with this? Because that's a, you know, and that's probably
well, that started back in the
70s. Yeah.
Like chairperson, we nearly always say chairperson now. Yep. It used to be chairman, mm-hmm. always. It didn't matter if a woman was in the chair. Now, you automatically say chairperson. Yep. Who's going to be the chair? Who's going to be the chair? Who's the chairperson? So it just takes a while sometimes for the language to catch up. And the use of the word Ms., you know, Ms., that is now on every form.
Ah, okay. Now,
interesting.
Yeah, this is a really good point, because Nick and I are just lighting our eyes up, because I heard a story that Ms. was in the 70s, probably before, was a term used for women who were unmarried and had a baby, or were not Miss, but not Mrs., somewhere in between.
It was a deliberate term to get away from the term Miss, which, you know, means you're about 15 years old, or Mrs., meaning you're married. So there was no in-between. So feminists decided that what we needed was a term that was respectful for us as whatever age. You could be a Mrs. or you could be a Miss, but you could use the word term Ms. And it's on every form now. It's splendid.
It's kind of funny, because a few years ago I had written Ms. Nicola Ramsey somewhere, and my mum kind of went, Ms.? Oh, no, I don't like that. I was like, well, what, you want me to be Miss? Because then people do expect me to be quite young. Yeah, I just don't like Ms. very much. I think it's always Ms. But I never could quite understand. I just wonder if that was my mum's kind of more old-fashioned kind of
generation thing. I'd say so. Yeah. Because Miss means you're unmarried, Mrs. means you're married. Well, you know, Mr. is a non... you know, term that could mean anything. It doesn't mean that he's married, unmarried. So we're stuck. We were stuck with the miss or the missus. The blokes all had mister. You know, so it was, again, a thing of, you know, how
that's
dare
so
you?
Why? There's no single married pronoun for men.
Well, that's right. My brothers used to use master. Master was
usually for boys.
Young boys, you see. But women were still, it didn't matter if you were 50, you were Miss. If you were not married, you were Miss. I mean, how ridiculous was that? Mm. So, Ms. cuts all through that. Now, a lot of women still like Misses. They still like looking as if they're married. Mm. So, you know, you didn't have to. So, it's on. Still, you could still be Miss or Mrs., but Ms., you had the choice. And men just got Mr., you know, like they didn't have to make any...
And it's interesting that in this era of fluidity, you are still required on all forms to put something that denotes your gender. Mr., Ms., Miss, Mrs., all that has to do with whether you are male or female.
Yeah, that's a patriarchal thing.
Yep.
They like to have us all...
Part of me wonders if, you know, there's always this big push to have your diversity in workplaces and things like that. So part of me wonders if they need to know their statistics just so they can see how far off they are from their numbers, because they ask someone.
Don't be surprised.
Yeah, that's, you know, fair enough. If it's going to work in my favour, I'm all for it. But,
right.
Yeah.
Well, we got a text in, and it's not particularly a nice one, but I'm going to throw it over to you guys anyway, because this probably ties into the whole idea of feminism and that idea of being courteous to women, and, you know, the male idea of opening doors and things. Because someone has written anonymously, obviously, remind me never to open a door for a woman, WOMYN, again.
Fine, but who wants it?
But they've done a bit of a smiley face, like kind of a wink at the end. So I don't think they're genuinely.
That's fine. I have no problem with that. I don't want the door open for me. You know, if I'm first at the door, I'll open it. If whoever's first at the door can open it, doesn't matter. But not have that sort of, you know, that shuffling at the door and, oh dear, I've got to stand back and wait for someone to open it.
It's ridiculous. I always just thought that was manners. If you had the door open and someone else was coming behind you, held it for them.
Mm-hmm.
regardless of who it was.
That's right. That's right.
That idea of chivalry and that idea that men are protectors and they need to be,
And that's right. And then we can't open our own car doors, you know, all of that stuff that you still see on the screen these days, you know, still see on TV.
Well, we're actually out of time tonight. We've got so engrossed in our chat that we've run out of time, so we really have to go. But thank you guys so much for coming in.
Can I just say one little thing?
Please.
That I want to just pay my respects to the Aboriginal community because Ruby Hunter died today.
Oh, right.
I'm not sure if you're aware, the very, very significant singer in the Aboriginal community, Archie Roach's partner. You might have heard of Archie Roach.
Heard of Archie Roach.
And I just want to say that extend our sympathies, particularly for the to the Aboriginal community, that they've lost a very valued and very significant member of the community, and she's much loved. And Artie and I have been to see Ruby and Archie many, many times, and we extend our sympathy to Archie in particular too. Just to say that, because it's very sad, actually.
Well, we'll send our condolences as well. Mm. That's a very sad news and a sad note in what's been an incredible hour of fun and chat. And thank you both so much for coming in.
Yes. Thank you for having us. We've enjoyed it immensely.
Thank you for including us.
Joy 94.9 is a GLBTIQ community radio station in Melbourne, Australia. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.